So I'll give you a few biographical details. So Matthew started, did his PhD in physics at Caltech, also a postdoc there working on LIGO. He moved to the European Gravitational Observatory to work on Virgo. And then he came back to MIT to work on advanced LIGO and became a professor of physics there a few years back. So Matt works on gravitational wave detector instrument design. And given all the exciting results coming out in the last few years, I think we're very fortunate to have him tell us all about the sort of state of the art and what's coming.
All right, thank you. And thanks for the invitation. I've never been out here before, so it's good to find out what the perimeter is like. I'm told the hockey stick is standard practice. Maybe I'll see if I can do this. Yeah. Okay, so if you haven't seen this video of black holes going around each other, this is kind of why I'm here to talk to you. Also, if you haven't seen it, you've probably been living in a cave or small town lost in the middle of Canada or something. I don't know. Anyhow, so I'm going to be talking to you about LIGO and in particular about the recent discoveries we've made, but I kind of assume you've heard most of that, so I'll move on to my own specialty, which is instrument design and where we're going in the future. Do people want to see that again? Do people seem to be excited about it? Okay, no, there are better ones coming later. All right, so most of the binary black hole systems we've detected have been kind of similar to the first one, which was what that animation was. So I'll talk about that guy for just a second. And also, I have these nice pictures. So basically, these black holes are about 30 solar masses. They go around each other, they run into each other, and they coalesce into a larger black hole. I guess everybody knows that a solar mass is one of those things. So this merger happened kind of a long ways away. If you put it in light years, it sounds like it's really far away, billions of light years. But on astro terms, this is a redshift of 0.1, right? So not all that far away, actually, relatively close. And an interesting thing from the theory point of view is that the black holes we've been detecting are not maximally spinning. There was, I guess, theoretical reason, maybe people here know much better than I do, theoretical reason to believe that we would detect black holes that were maximally spinning. And I think that's why Kip Thorne put Gargantua like this in Interstellar, right, with this particular structure. So this is not what we got, right? We did not get a Kip Thorne maximally spinning Gargantua black hole. We got these things which are relatively slowly spinning, if at all. So analysis speak, the posteriors are consistent with zero. I won't talk much about posteriors here. All right, so there's a few fun facts about these collisions, and the first one in particular that I just love, so I'm going to tell you about them, in case you haven't done this math on your own. If you add up the masses of the black holes that went into this collision and subtract off the mass of the final black hole, you find that something like 3 solar masses went missing in the process, right? So E equals mc squared, that's a lot of energy that went out. And in fact, you can compare it to things like how much light is coming out of our sun. So our sun has lost 0.03% of its mass in 5 billion years, right? This is 10,000 times more energy in less than a second. All of this happened. This collision happened in under a second, about a quarter of a second for the first event. All right, so if you take just the power output, energy per time, you find that that's actually brighter than all the stars in the known universe added up together, very, very briefly. Of course, it's not coming out in electromagnetic radiation, it's coming out as gravitational waves, but just the energy flux, luminosity, is larger. And you can also calculate the flux on Earth, and it's roughly equivalent to the full moon. Right, in terms of energy flux through the Earth in gravitational waves. Right? You would think that that wouldn't be that hard to detect. It turns out it's quite challenging, and that just speaks to how very stiff space-time is. So after the first event, we detected many others of these binary black holes, and each of them is kind of special in its own way. There's the biggest and the farthest, the best localized, the smallest, the highest spin. Right? There are other characters that have been added more recently. They're still few enough that they can be individually interesting, but we're starting to approach the I've seen more than 10 in them limit of we can just group them all together and say there's a lot of black holes. And we're learning some fun things from these. I just picked a couple of my favorites. So when I was working on LIGO back before we detected anything, like the main goal in my mind was always to somehow test general relativity. There's no reason to believe that a theory is good 10 or 13 or 14 orders of magnitude beyond the region that it's ever been tested in before. It could have just been wrong, right? We all like to believe that GR is right, but it could have just been wrong. It turns out it doesn't seem like it was. So that's sort of amazing. But that was one of the things that I had in my mind before we detected anything, is maybe this whole thing is just never going to work because there aren't any gravitational waves, there aren't any black holes. It's just not going to work out, right? But okay, got past that one. And the other thing was, I was not expecting black holes, right? So there are people who had said that we were going to detect black holes before bioneutron stars. I didn't think that was true. I had done studies as a graduate student of the population of bioneutron stars. I was quite sure that would be the first thing we detected, right? Not so. So we discovered that there's this new population, unknown population, not new, but unknown, of these large black holes out there flying around in the universe. Okay, so this again is a collection of our black holes we've detected with solar masses on that axis, nothing in particular on this axis, and down here a bunch of neutron stars. And I have circled one particular pair of neutron stars, which is the one that we detected most recently. If you hadn't heard about it, it was quite a wonderful cosmic cataclysm, which resulted in some awesome animations. This one's by NASA. So here we have our two neutron stars going around each other, and they're emitting gravitational waves, which we eventually detected with LIGO. And then they ran into each other, and because there's matter involved, not just black holes, it made this huge explosion, which was then detected as a gamma ray burst and by a bunch of telescopes, which I'll talk about here in a second. So this was really exciting for us, because up until this point, people could say, you know, you LIGO guys, maybe you're just doing all your analysis wrong, maybe you're making it up, whatever. There was, I mean, somehow you know you've made it when there are conspiracy theories about your work, right? So there were conspiracy theories about LIGO, but it was all just bunk, right? But once you have like 70 telescopes out there pointing and taking pictures, harder to believe that it's bunk. All right, so here's the collection of telescopes that got images of this bioneutron star coalescence. And we started out with gamma rays, and then we got some, you know, sort of relatively short wavelength visible stuff, and then really fades to infrared. Later on, there was a weird little X-ray pulse, which was not expected, and then radio, which is what we expect to come out for a long time. All right, so we kind of covered the whole electromagnetic spectrum, or at least the easy part of it, with this event. And this shows how the spectrum evolved. I have a clicker in my hand, I should probably use it. How it evolved in time, starting out quite blue and then getting redder with time. This is as days are going by. All right, so this was not entirely expected, but not completely unexpected. So this is a kilonova, is what this sort of event was known as and remains known as. We didn't really follow the model, but more or less, it was easy to identify as, yes, that's what it really is. We need to tune our model or our understanding of kilonovas. But pretty much, this is what you'd expect. The process which generates the explosion, at least a large part of it, is something called the R process. And it makes, it's rapid for rapid nuclear decay. And it generates a whole bunch of elements in the periodic table. So the yellow parts of each one of these things are showing the fraction of each of these elements which is generated in the universe from bioneutron star coalescences. And people like to talk about the gold and platinum that you have coming out of here. You have, you know, a lot of the gold and platinum in the world, or in the universe and also in the world, apparently comes from bioneutron star collisions. So I hadn't really appreciated until this moment that if it weren't for gravitational waves, the universe would be a different place, right? I had kind of always thought, something that we might be able to use as a tool to understand the universe, that kind of thing, but not that that really they're fundamental in some way. So if you didn't have gravitational waves, didn't have gravitational radiation taking energy away from these systems, they would just do this for a very long time, and you would never make all those elements. All right, so you'd have a rather different universe if you didn't have gravitational waves coming out of these binary systems. And I got this picture somehow relatively early in the whole affair before this thing was public, and it was just my favorite. The lights are not exactly perfect, they're pretty good, but this is a Hubble image of the galaxy, NGC 4993, that our event was around, and there's our little guy. So when I saw a picture of Hubble, you know, a picture from Hubble of our little event, I was like, okay, that's it. Like, that's real. That's our guy. So that was pretty special. There have been a bunch of things that we've learned from this bioneutron star coalescence, and we're still learning more almost daily. So there's a lot of papers coming out. I think we're into the hundreds, many hundreds at this point, of citations for the event original sort of discovery paper. And I don't really want to go down the list, because I suspect some of you have seen these things, but interesting things are things like measure the speed of gravitational wave propagation relative to the speed of light to 10 to the 15, or a part in 10 to the 15. So that's really good. That's just the 2-second time difference between the two and the distance out. Right? And we start, I want to say getting hints of, maybe not, but anyway, start constraining in some way the neutron star equation of state. We get some hints of tidal deformability there. Right? We get some idea of what the merger rate is out in the universe. It's a lot to be learned from this single event. Hopefully, even more to be learned from more of these events as we start running again. Okay, so that's the backdrop. Now I'm going to take a step back and get to the stuff that I spend my time working on more regularly. So I'll start with just, what are gravitational waves and how do we detect them? Does anyone know the answer to these two questions? Raise your hand. Yeah, mostly, kind of, sort of. You guys are all very shy. You sit in the back. You don't really want to talk to me. If you have questions, you know, just say them. Interrupt, that's fine. Okay, so gravitational waves are, to me, as an experimentalist, just things moving, right? Stuff moves. I don't really need to know anything about general relativity to try to detect these things. So this blue oscillating tube is, if I had a bunch of rings of test masses laid out in a tube and I propagate a gravitational wave down the axis of that tube, this is how that tube would move. If I slice off a piece of it and lay it out here, I get, start with a ring like that, I can throw down some little red test masses on there, they'll be useful later. And when my gravitational wave goes by, this thing stretches in that direction. It's basically just moving the test masses on this ring out in that direction and in this direction, and then oscillating back and forth. We quantify this in terms of strain. So I can take the little motions I get on the edges here, take the difference between the two of them. They have opposite signs, so that's a positive number. That's our delta L divided by the radius of that ring, which we call L because it's the length of our detectors. That fractional change in length is a strain, like any sort of mechanical strain. And the fraction we're looking for, this is number came from Kip Thorne before we detected it, but it happens to be right, is a part in 10 to the minus 21, or a part in 10 to the 21. That's a perfectly reasonable place if you're an experimentalist to just say, I'm going to do something else with my life. Right? That's a good place to just, I'm going to go do high energy physics. I don't know. I don't care how bad it looks. It looks better than this. Right? That's a really, really, really small number. So to give you an idea of just how small that is, I take the length of a LIGO detector, 4 kilometers, multiply it by that, and I should be measuring a distance which is 4 times 10 to the minus 18 meters. And you can see my hydrogen atom here, and that's 10 to the minus 10 box, 10 to the minus 11, 12, 13, 14. Here comes the proton, edge of the proton, 16, 17. The little square is 10 to the minus 18. Right? And that's the motion we're looking for. Okay, so the good news is that Michelson and Morley measured something 5 times 10 to the minus 9. So it's a few orders of magnitude off, 9 orders of magnitude off. But still, that was 1887, right? And they did this with the sodium lamp. I thought it was a candle, but apparently they had a sodium lamp, some half-silvered mirrors. I mean, this is 18-something, right? And they're at 10 to the minus 9. So certainly we can do this. We have better technology these days. So the way we do it is with laser interferometry. And for those of you who remember your Michelson interferometer from when you were an undergrad, it looks something like this. You send in a laser beam. When you move the mirrors, the interference pattern changes here at the output. The way this works is you have some electromagnetic waves. These are not gravitational waves, they're electromagnetic waves. Propagating along, they go out and hit the mirrors on the end. Those are the red test masses up there in the corner, if you remember the blue ring. The waves propagate back to the beam splitter, and we set it up so that here they cancel. I like the hockey stick. Right, here they cancel, so we get no light going this way, all the light's going that way, and then we do complicated things with it. And then when these things move, you change the interference condition, and that lets some light leak out to this side. So our job is really just to detect this light. Turns out that's relatively easy. You put a photodetector there. It's like if you have a solar panel on top of your house, that's a big piece of silicon, and it's converting photons into electrons. There's a current, which you can then measure. That's what we're doing here, right? Same sort of thing. Unlike your undergraduate lab, you have to make this thing really big for it to work. Remember, this, the whole signal was proportional to the size of the instrument. Right, that was the L in the ring, the radius of the ring. So our length is the length from the beam splitter, which sits here, to the end of the arm, which is down there. That's our 4 kilometers for LIGO. This is the Hanford site in Washington State. And the Louisiana site, it's much greener. So one's sort of desert, the other one's basically swamp. The idea is something big and flat where you don't have a lot of people living. And that's how you can build one of these big detectors. All right, so we have two of them, essentially identical, rather different backdrops. So here's where they're located. And to give a sense of scale, the arm tubes going off here, that's actually a cement bunker. And Lisa here is about 152 centimeters tall, right? So pretty large. And then inside of this building there is the vacuum system that holds the optics, which are here. Of course, there's more of them down towards the end. This is one of our normal vacuum chambers. Jamie's a little over 2 meters tall, so he's taller than I am by a good bit, right? And he looks kind of small compared to these things, right? So there's a very large vacuum system involved. So to go from the thing you built as an undergrad in, you know, some little experiment where you were measuring, you did a good job, 10 to the minus 14 meters with that, to something where you're at 10 to the minus 18 meters, you have to scale it up, and then we also need to make the whole thing longer to make the signal bigger. But LIGO is, in some sense, just a big glorified Michelson interferometer. All right, so there's a lot of complexity to it, which I'm not going to talk about. We actually have, so those are the two end mirrors of our Michelson. We have a bunch more mirrors that we didn't stick in here to try to take our sort of 100 watt laser and turn it into something like a megawatt of power in the arms. That's what makes our signals big. A lot of control loops that keep everything in place. I kind of assume that you guys don't care too much about this stuff. The important part is that over here we get a signal which comes out, which actually lets us measure something. And along with that signal, we have some noise. So, oh no, I didn't get the sound set up. I'm an instrumentalist. This is going to work, right? Okay, we'll do without. I'll just tell you about it. The message here is pretty simple. If you listen to, this is the bioneutron star signal, which you can see appearing in time as it goes along, and you'll see a track appear here in frequency space. Your ears are pretty good at picking these things out, so if the audio were working, you would hear this thing go whoop up in frequency with some noise in the background. Right, and your ability to hear that thing chirping up in frequency is entirely determined by the size of the noise. So I have this nice recording which plays twice, once with a normal noise in which you can just barely hear that thing, and one...
You want to try this connector there?
Oh, I did try it. It's plugged in, it's just not going. It's okay, I'll just go on, it's fine.
Maybe you can imitate.
I'm trying out my skills to imitate this one. The point of the thing is that if you want to detect these astrophysical sources, if you really want to get farther out into the universe, the instrument design becomes the critical feature, and we quantify that in terms of the noise that comes out of the instrument. So the way I'll spend my time, if I'm at one of the observatories, and if I can, I'll get the headphones plugged in and just listen to it, or you can put it on the speakers. It kind of tends to drive people in the control room crazy. But you listen to these instruments. They're audio band signals, so 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz. And your ear is a pretty good Fourier transform, pretty good sensor for these things. You can really understand a lot just by listening to these noise curves. But to me, this is the business is to move the noise down, right? And that determines the distance to which we can hear things. Let me say a little bit about how these things are quantified. So the frequency is on this axis. The amplitude of the noise is on that axis. Up is noisier, that's bad. The funny units up here are per root hertz is because it's a power spectrum. But we take the square root because we want an amplitude. So you end up with a square root hertz in the denominator, which is initially confusing, but eventually you come to love it. If you want to make this thing into a, you know, make a RMS of a signal, you should square it and integrate it like that. But to just look at the amplitude of the noise and understand what you're going to get in terms of strain, this is sort of the nice way to do it, amplitude spectral densities. So I'll make plots like this, and the whole point is I want it to go down. If I can move it down by a factor of two, that means I can detect things twice as far away. So as we went from the initial detectors to advanced LIGO, where we made our first detections, one of the big changes was to turn up the laser power. So more power coming out of the laser here, and that reduces the shot noise up here. And so this is, shot noise is really just photon counting noise. We're measuring the light on some photodetector. That light is coming in little packets. We're counting them essentially. And there's some noise in that counting process because it's a Poisson process. There's a corresponding radiation pressure noise. And this is the photons which are in the interferometer are bouncing off of the mirrors. And every time a photon gets bounced off a mirror, it gives a little kick. There's a noise there as well. So you get noise on the one side, you see kicking your test masses around. I mean, those guys are 40 kilograms, but it's a very sensitive measurement. So we care about the photons kicking them around. And that determines a low frequency noise. As you turn up the laser power, this one comes down, and that one goes up. Okay. So this is what I call quantum noise in our detector. When I talk about quantum noise, that's quantum light, not quantum gravity. Sorry, I don't know anything about quantum gravity. The other big noise source for us is thermal noise. And our detectors don't operate, and they operate at room temperature. They're not cryogenic. The reason for that is when you have a megawatt of power running around, it's hard to keep things cold. Right? So it's hard to extract that kind of power. Basically, we improve thermal noise by improving our materials. So if you have stuff which is like wood, gummy, and awful, then it will be very noisy. If you have things like glass or things which are high Q, low mechanical loss factors, then you get low thermal noise. So I'll focus just on this side of the curve, the high frequency side. Turns out there's some interesting astrophysics to be found out here, so I'll just talk about this end for the moment. As I said, going from initial LIGO to advanced LIGO is a matter of turning up the power. Right now, we're kind of halfway there, right? So we're not yet at the design sensitivity of advanced LIGO. We're still working on trying to get more laser power into the detectors. We have a little more than a factor of two that we can win in sensitivity, so there's actually still a lot of potentially higher event rates that we can get just by approaching the design sensitivity of the detectors. The big changes, I've mentioned initial LIGO now a couple of times, the big changes that went into going from what I was working on when I was a graduate student, which was the initial version, to the thing I was designing at MIT, the big changes, I mean, there were many, many people designing it. I was one of them. Better isolation systems, right? So we have seismic isolation. We want to keep the ground vibrations from getting in, a lot more laser power, and better materials. This is our thermal noise. That's our quantum noise, and that's getting rid of the vibrations from the ground. So let's just say that all of that works. Project yourself a year or two down the road and imagine that, you know, we actually succeed in getting towards the design sensitivity. It's reasonable to ask, where are we going next? Do we just keep turning up the power? And it turns out you can't just keep turning up the power. And the reasons for that are, one, I mentioned there's radiation pressure noise, which will go up. We already are at sort of the design is nominally ideal. If you turn up the power more, you actually add more noise through radiation pressure than you get rid of with shot noise. Your sensitivity gets worse. And then there's a bunch of technical stuff. So you start to heat up your mirrors. They start to curve a little bit. These things are already have a radius of curvature of several kilometers. So it doesn't take very much before they just don't work anymore. And you end up with also some radiation pressure driven instabilities. You'd be surprised to find that just the light pushing the mirrors around or exciting mechanical modes in the mirror can be a huge problem in these detectors. So when you have a lot of power on something which is sensitive to very small displacements, radiation pressure effects are dominant in a lot of the things we do. A simple example is our alignment control actually has to compensate for the fact that when you tilt the mirrors, the laser beam shifts. If you tilt the mirrors like this, the laser beam wants to shift out and it actually adds torque, and it can completely destabilize the suspensions. Again, it's a 40 kilogram mirror hanging from a suspension, but the radial curvature is such that a small tilt makes a big displacement. If you put that into a spring constant, it can overcome the spring constant of a suspension. Our control systems have to keep everything aligned against these radiation pressure effects. Okay, so if we can't turn up the power, how do we make things better? When I was putting together this talk, I asked what would be interesting, and I was told quantum and future. So I'm going to talk about the quantum noise in our detector and how we improve on it. When I say go back to the beginning, what I mean is you have to figure out where the quantum noise is actually coming from. Now, you might think that the quantum noise in an interferometer comes in with the laser. It comes in with the photons, right? That would make sense. It comes in over here, and somehow, like our signal, it comes out to our detector. It turns out that's not how things actually work, right? The vast majority of the light which comes in over here actually goes back towards the laser. Very little of it is sent to this side of the detector. The same thing is true for the quantum noise, which I'll talk about as vacuum fluctuations. This is the zero-point energy of the electromagnetic field if you're doing quantum optics. I'll just say vacuum fluctuations. The vacuum fluctuations which come in over here reflect back to the laser. They don't bother us. So the thing that's actually interesting for us is the noise which comes in where our signal is going out. Sort of by symmetry, that gets reflected back and comes over here to our photodetector. So if you're thinking about your quantum noise in terms of counting statistics, you'll get the source wrong. It's not coming in with the laser. If you want to reduce the quantum noise in the detector, you have to focus on what's coming in over here, where the signal is coming out. So you can quantify the noise in terms of its two quadratures, amplitude and phase. So in quantum optics, everything is a harmonic oscillator. And as you remember, certainly from your basic quantum mechanics classes, you have like x and p, position and momentum. Those are your two quadratures. Here we'll just call them x1 and x2, or amplitude and phase noise. And this little round ball is supposed to show that I have equal noise or uncertainty in both directions. You can think of this as like the Gaussian ground state of a harmonic oscillator. So what we can do about this is we can do something called squeezing. Again, a classic example from like initial quantum mechanics courses, where you reduce the uncertainty in one quadrature. Heisenberg says you must therefore increase it in the other quadrature. That's fine, we'll do that, right? Because our signal comes out in one quadrature. So if we can make the uncertainty small in our signal quadrature, we can allow it to be large in the other quadrature, and that's fine. So we allow for more amplitude noise or more phase noise depending on where our signal comes out. Right, this is the fundamental idea behind squeezing. When I saw this the first time, I was sitting in a bar in Florida, and I thought the guy who was telling me this was really completely full of it. Like, there's no way, yeah, fine, you can draw the picture, but how are you actually going to do that and make it work? Never going to happen, right? It turns out it's not that bad. What you need is some nonlinear crystal. Our light in the interferometer is 1 micron. So we have to pump this nonlinearity with double that energy, so half the wavelength, so 532, which is green. So we pump it with a lot of green light, and this thing down converts green photons into pairs of red photons. These entangled photons are, in fact, our squeezed vacuum state, which we send in to our detector, comes back out on this side, and with that, we can reduce the noise. This has been demonstrated. I see now that I did not include the demonstration plot. This has been demonstrated at Hanford. We did a demonstration there where we got 2 point something dB, like a 20% decrease in noise. Not much, just a little bit, right? But enough to know that this could work. And that was with the initial LIGO detectors. Since then, we've been building squeezers and working on the design. And just recently, we were actually installed a squeezed light source at both observatories. And now a few months back, but during February, I was in Louisiana helping with the testing of this squeezed light source. So the idea is that's what lets us go from here farther down. Now the curve you see here in light blue doesn't look like a lot. It's kind of a factor of 2. This is our first go around, right? We don't want to overpromise what we can accomplish here. So factor of 2 for us is a relatively big deal. Yeah, please.
Matt, is this part of the whatever is going to be done for O3, or is it being fast forward?
Yeah. Yes. Maggie is actually, she just got back to MIT, but she spent most of a year there getting the squeezer going, I mean, installed, built, installed, ready to go, so they'll be going for O3. We're not 100% certain it's going to work. And depending on how much laser power we can get in, we're not 100% certain how useful it will be. The more power we get in, the less useful squeezing is. I can tell people why if they want to know. But hopefully, you know, Maggie will be going back when the interferometer is up and running again. And yeah, we hope to have this running for O3. I'm not sure what we're going to get out of it.
Except
for
both.
Yeah, so the Hanford crew is also, they have a squeezer installed. They haven't tested it with the interferometer yet. So we were able to test this squeeze light source with the interferometer. We got a little more than 1 dB out of it in the testing back in February. So it's, you know, just getting started. But we have some time between now and the next observing run. So yeah, we hope it'll be running.
Wait, so what do you mean by O3?
Yeah. So each of the times that we stop working on the instrument and start taking data, we give them a name. And our names are not very creative. So the first one was O1. That's observing run 1. And then O2. And then,
so when is O3?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah. So O3 will happen when we have significantly improved the detectors. In the field, what that means is when we get to 120 megaparsecs with both detectors, that's our goal before we start the next observing run. The reason is just that we don't want to spend a lot of time running if we know what to do to fix the detectors. At the same time, if you've made a really significant improvement, it feels like you need to go and get some data. All right, so our goal is 120. We're hoping that to get there by the end of the year. So nominally, that's our target. Yeah, it's the end of this year. But I don't want to quote a date really because it's dangerous. Research is unpredictable. Okay, so a lot of what I work on, this is a picture from one of the labs at MIT. A lot of what I work on is things like the squeeze light source. So thinking about what we're doing in really the near term for the advanced LIGO detectors. When I can, I go to the observatories and work on them. Honestly, since I teach these days, there are large chunks of time in which I can't just go off to the observatories, so my students do it. But this is a, you know, a reasonable chunk of how I spend my time, working on better materials for the coatings on the mirrors to get the thermal noise down, working on squeezers, try to get the quantum noise down, things like that. That might get us a factor of 2 or 3, right? That's what we're going to get out of this. Sort of the best we can realistically hope for is a factor of 2 or 3. So when we think about the next big step, I think we've collectively admitted at this point that we're not going to get another factor of 10 from being clever, that we need to get the next factor of 10 from just spending more money. So the next big step is probably to build a new facility. So the next little section of my talk is about how do we go beyond advanced LIGO. Right. How do we go beyond and where can we go? Yes.
Before you do that, how is this going to compare to what the Europeans have when you're done?
How is it going to compare to what the Europeans have when we're done? That's all future tense, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, next week, future tense.
Next week. Oh, so I mean, in terms of what the Europeans have now, which is Virgo, the Virgo detector compared to the advanced LIGO, by done, you mean O3. Yeah, okay. So Virgo was about 20 megaparsecs, I think is the right number, was their range. If you don't know the units, that's fine. The ratios are what's important. Whereas we were operating at, let's say, the good detector, Livingston, was operating about 100. It's roughly a factor of 5 was the ratio. And I hope they can close that gap for the next observing run, but it's not entirely obvious. Because they joined O2, the previous observing run, just at the very end for a month or so. It was a very lucky month, but that was the only time they were there. And their sensitivity was, I would say, ratty. I mean, it had a lot of non-stationarities, a lot of features in the spectrum, but I mean, they really rushed to get something going. They got something on, it was awesome. But there's a lot of work left to do on Virgo. So they're still where we were a few years back, kind of thing. So they're still winding up. They're doing what they can, but they're a little bit behind. I thought you meant in the end, like, right? So, so that's a picture of Bonneville Salt Flats near Salt Lake City. And I picked that because it was the inspiration for this picture. So this is the name I use for the one of the ideas we have for a future detector. In particular, this is the one that I'm sort of responsible for, as opposed to the European version, which I thought what you might have been talking about, known as the Einstein Telescope. So I will talk about Cosmic Explorer because it's my baby, but that's not the only thing out there. It's one of the ideas for what we could do for a next generation detector. So by bigger, I mean this should be something like 40 kilometers instead of 4. Obviously, the buildings are not to scale. If you make them to scale, you can't see them. So anyhow, the idea is that a very large thing located in a desert or salt flats or a big dry lake bed or something like that, which you can find near Salt Lake. And the reason why we do that is we think that we can get improvement in sensitivity from advanced LIGO, which is this dashed curve, to something like that. This is our factor of 2 or 3. We could probably get in the current facilities, right? Just by being clever, by doing things better, we can do this. But if we want to go beyond that, we probably just have to make it bigger. If you remember all the way back at the beginning with the little blue rings, there was the L in there and all of our signal scales with L, right? If we make this thing longer, we basically just get that much more signal. So if we, as we go from 4 kilometers to 40 kilometers, right, our sensitivity gets just essentially that much better. Now there's a little more to it than that, but that's the basic idea. There's, you know, the ETD thing here is the name of a European design. It's 10 kilometers long. You can see it's similar to this design, which is 10 kilometers. So of course, we have sibling rivalries, but pretty much just as you make it bigger, it gets more sense. So what do you get out of this? This plot is showing the total mass of a binary system. I'm assuming equal mass, no spin, the simplest thing you could have. And on this axis, we have the redshift of that source. And this solid brown curve would be the maximum distance at which we could detect a source with this Cosmic Explorer 40 kilometer detector. Right? The gray one would be a similar sort of thing for the European Einstein Telescope detector. So this red bar is reionization. Right? This is when our first stars were forming. And this mass of about 3 is where we expect to find bineutron stars. So a detector like this would be detecting, it would have a shot at detecting all of the bineutron stars in the universe. So my probability isn't equal to 1 anywhere. It's sort of fading towards 0, but it fades towards 0 out here at a redshift of kind of 10. You aren't going to have any of these things out there. Yes?
Don't you get like some effect similar to lensing when you go to these high redshifts?
So we get a redshift of the masses. So the gravitational wave signal gets redshifted like anything else. And to us, that's degenerate with the mass of the system. So the signal appears to have come from a more massive source as it gets redshifted. It just gets shifted down in frequency, which for us looks like higher mass. And in fact, if you look at these curves on this edge, you notice that the various shaded regions showing higher probability detection are all sort of all packed together. And that comes from the fact that as you go to those high redshifts, you're basically just shifting sources out of band, right? And then it doesn't matter anymore really what the mass is of it. I mean, it's just the question is just where do I hit the redshift where the thing has fallen off out of my band?
Yeah, but you have something that's like a redshift of 10 or something on the way to us.
Huh.
It can just meet another black hole and distort the signal.
Yeah, of course.
Couple these things from that.
Yeah, so this is assuming a universe which is otherwise empty to make these plots. I know that people have done a number of calculations about what's the probability of having sources be lensed. I believe the answer is that the vast majority of sources will not be lensed. So that's why I feel the freedom to ignore it here. I thought the number was something like 1%, but I don't know how speculative that number is. My understanding, though I didn't do the math myself, my understanding is that it's relatively infrequent that you get a lensed source, where it's significantly magnified, I should say. I mean, there's always a little bit of lensing.
The fraction of lens sources is just the omega in the lens.
So
if the black holes comprise an omega of 0.01, then 0.01 of the distant objects you see will be lensed. So it's a small fraction.
Yeah. So I just ignore them to make this plot. Other questions before I rush on this one? No? Okay, so.
So what's your best target for the, cosmic?
Cosmic Explorer, yeah. So the things that I'm really after is to get a shot at the whole population of binary neutron stars, so really all of them. Yeah, I mean, we expect that these things will peak around redshift of 2 or 3, and really there won't be anything left by the time you get to redshift of 10. And then for binary black hole systems, our redshift goes out to sort of crazy out here, where you're not going to find anything unless they're primordial black holes, right? So you might be finding primordial black holes redshift of 30, but not things as stellar remnants. So again, here you can really get the whole population of stellar remnants from this sort of detector. And even things like maybe population 3 stars, which could form very heavy binaries, which live over here somewhere. Right? But you really get a survey of all the remnants of everything out there that makes binaries. So there was a paper came out a little while back by Emmanuel Berti, in which he and co-authors, I don't know if you guys know the names here, but Chris Belchinsky is also there, took this various sensitivity curves the instrumentalists like myself had put together, there were a lot of them, and took them very seriously, and went through each one of these and calculated what would be the astrophysical rate. So what are you going to detect in terms of sources for each of these various curves? Right, I won't go through each one of them. The progression is from where we were during the first observing run over here, which is that guy over there, to this Cosmic Explorer, one of the versions of it, which is this blue guy down there. That's the progression going down. And for those, they were calculating the thing I call high SNR was something we're thinking, they're saying that maybe you can say something about the ring down after the merger, right? What's your signal to noise ratio on the ring down? Can you say something interesting about quantum gravity here or something like that? I don't know. What impressed me about this whole thing was that they're detectable sources approaching 10 to the 6, right? You get a huge number of sources. When you're seeing the whole universe, you're really not limited. All these points are kind of the same in terms of the numbers, because you're not really so much limited just in terms of rate by the detector sensitivity. You're getting a shot at sort of everything. And the numbers get very large. So if you're looking to do population studies, you're looking to do something which has good statistics, we'll be able to do it with these future detectors. Unlike now, where we have, not quite 10 binary black holes, so you're limited to rather poor statistics in which each one is kind of special. Here you can really have a survey of the population. You'd also have a fairly high number, so hundreds of sources in which the signal noise ratio is very high. So you could do precision studies, but you could do them with not, one or two sources, but with a few hundred sources. So this plot is showing from the same paper, showing the number of sources as a function of redshift bin. And the point here is really just to say that the majority of sources, we believe, will live at a redshift of roughly 3. But the tail could extend out to redshift of sort of 10. And then exactly how far depends on relatively unknown population out at high redshifts. There's no other way that I know of that you detect individual sources at these redshifts, except maybe quasars. But it's very hard to find things like stellar remnants at redshift of 10 or 12. So this last plot is really intended to just make the point of high signal to noise ratio. For sources that are at a redshift of 1 or less, the signal to noise ratio for these events is hundreds. For something like the events we're detecting now, in a future detector, the SNR could be as high as 1,000. Right? And that's by virtue of the fact that the detectors go somewhat lower in frequency, where that's where most of the signal is. And at those lower frequencies, they're actually a few orders of magnitude more sensitive. You can get into the hundreds for these SNRs, as opposed to 30, which is about the highest we've detected right now. OK, so I'm going to wrap it up. Before I do, I have to say that I've spent my whole time talking about gravitational waves from the detectors that I know and love, which live over here in the gravitational wave spectrum. I don't mean to be disrespecting everybody else. There's a lot of other things going on in gravitational waves. I think the LISA mission has a launch date, which is so much more real than it was. I mean, when I was a graduate student, this picture already existed, I think. Something like that. And it was 10 years away. It was going to launch. right? And the launch date has been getting farther and farther away with time as sort of reality worked into the equation. But now it actually has a launch date, which is 2034 nominally, right? Which is a ways out. Okay, I admit it, but at least it has a launch date, right? That's going to happen, right? And that will be huge. You can detect very low frequency sources, tons of them with enormous signal-to-noise ratio. So these are intermediate mass black holes. I mean, that's going to be amazing. Pulsar timing, it's a slow business. They're looking for nanohertz. My favorite joke is that when you tell a graduate student that your signal is nanohertz, all the good ones just go somewhere else because they think nanohertz, 5 years. Nope, not going to do that. Right? Anyway, and the CMB, there's been some turbulence along the way, but I think that we have good results coming there as well. Wrong way. Okay, so the message. The message is that we're finally producing results. It seems like this is old news. This was just a couple of years ago. Like 3 years ago, nobody wanted to hear a colloquium from me, right? It's not quite true, but almost, right? There was relatively little interest, and everyone in astrophysics sort of thought we were just wasting their money. So this is relatively new, and to me still a big deal. Improving our understanding of the universe, fine. There's a lot of room for improvement in these detectors. We haven't even gotten to the design sensitivity. We're already adding some features that are intended for upgrades, like squeeze light. But there's a lot of room for improvement here. Factor of 2 or 3 in sensitivity means that factor cubed in terms of event rate. There's a lot we can do here with these current detectors. It's still a factor of 2 or 3, so your event rate might get to 1 per day.
Was the error bar on that?
It's getting smaller. When I was a graduate student, it was about 4 orders of magnitude in either direction, the error bars, and of course the black hole event rate extended to 0, which is why I didn't think we'd really ever detect those. So now the error bars are sort of an order of magnitude, but they're getting better. Getting better. And the thing to keep in mind when you're thinking about theory and theory you might like to test is that we won't always be in this regime of an SNR of 30 is kind of the best we're likely to do. Maybe 1 per day or 100 in a year sort of thing. At some point in the not so distant future, I hope maybe comparable to the LISA launch date, we'll have detectors where we're getting hundreds of thousands of detections per year. And some of them with signal-to-noise ratio of 1,000, that level of sensitivity. All right, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, starting with the students, are there any questions?
So why did you think that the black hole merger event rate is going to be 0?
Because we'd never detected one before, right? For neutron stars, right? So one of the things I did as a graduate student was I studied the population of binary star systems that have been detected as pulsars, right? And from that, you can build some reasonable rate. You have to make a model of the galaxy and a model of all the radio surveys and dispersion measures and all of this, but you build some estimate of the rate, right? And from that, I could calculate with some pretty large error bars, but there was a reasonably good chance that we would detect binary stars with advanced LIGO. And I'd even, marginalized over my priors and posteriors and got the answer. And I said, sometime in 2017, right? Plus or minus a few years, but before 2020, I might get tenure with this, right? That was what I was at. So that was, right? And it's going to be binary stars. It can work, right? So that's why I was focused on that one, because it was a source that we knew was out there. We could calculate a rate, and the error bars on the rate were not ridiculously large. Right, but black holes of 30 solar masses, like there are plenty of people who tell you they just don't exist, right? Just don't exist. And I mean, to their credit, there were a few people, but very few, who said these will be your dominant source. But very few people. The vast majority were like, no.
They didn't have good reason.
Hmm?
They didn't have good reason.
Well, so honestly, I was at a conference in June before our first detection, right? A few months before, in which people put out the two formation mechanisms, which are now sort of believed to be probably the ones. And the two they put out, actually, population 3 stars, I think, is probably still weak as a dominant formation mechanism, maybe a few, but probably not much. That one was put out, POP 3 stars. And the other one was these dense stellar environments, which is still plausible formation mechanism.
But very uncertain.
Still uncertain, clearly. I mean, everyone would like to say, we know the LIGO rate, and therefore we know the rate of our favorite source, because ours is obviously the dominant one. But anyhow, so the reason why I didn't think about binary black holes is because the rate could have been zero, and there are plenty of people who believe that it ought to be zero. Other questions?
So Matt, you mentioned, as you were comparing the number of sources you have with the Cosmic Explorer, that LIGO nowadays is treating each case special, but that's going to change very quickly, right? So what's...
Yeah, I think we're getting to the edge of that, right? I think when you get past 10 or so, then you have to just pick the ones that are really somehow particularly special if you want to. I mean, obviously the question is, do we write an individual paper for this source or not? Right. One reasonable answer to that question is we do until the editors send them back to us. Right. You just keep doing it until they say no. And that could be one way to find out what's the right number. But also, I think the truth is that the people in the collaboration are getting, maybe we're the most bored with some of these binary black hole systems. They kind of look like all the rest of them. I don't think that we can muster the energy to publish about them. On the other hand, with 1,000 people in the collaboration, there's almost always somebody who thinks this is the most interesting black hole.
Right, but let me just follow up that question. So maybe with your LSE hat, but with one over 1,000 at some point, given the rate at which you guys can process the analysis, O3 is going to challenge what you can do. So what's going to happen then?
So joint run planning committee chair, I guess you know who that is, so it's Lisa. Lisa said at some point, she was the one standing on the beam tube, by the way. So Lisa said at some point, the next observing wind is going to be a disaster for one of two reasons. Either we won't get the instruments to the design sensitivity, or to the sensitivity we're expecting, or hoping for, 120 megabars. Either we won't make it, or we will. And the analysis community will have no idea what to do with all these sources, right? So maybe we'll hit somewhere in between these two disasters. I don't know. It can be a problem, right? It can be a problem that you can have a little too much to process. And in terms of the collaboration's organization, it wasn't originally designed with the idea of we have to deal with many sources, right? The whole collaboration and the LIGO Lab was designed around the idea of we have to detect something, right? At least one of something at some point, right? That was the design idea. So, and we have to be really, really sure of it. That was the other part of the design idea. So there's a lot of carefulness that's built into everything. And then it's hard to make high rate and careful at the same time.
Can you store all the data or not?
Hmm?
Can you store all the data?
Yeah, it's not that much. I mean, it's not small, but it's not that bad. It's not like high energy physics where you just have to sort through as fast as you possibly can.
You can store it.
Yeah, most of it. I mean, certainly the main gravitational wave channel, one time series at 16 kilohertz, it's fine. All the auxiliary channels, you can pick the most interesting ones and store them for essentially indefinitely.
You mentioned a 40 kilometer upgrade as a possibility. Why 40?
Yeah, that's a very good question. 40 turns out to be interesting for a number of reasons. One of them is that the curvature of the Earth is such that as you make something longer, you have to dig in the middle and fill the ends or something like that. And the depth, the sagitta, the depth to which you have to dig goes with the square of the length. And at 40 kilometers, that's about 30 meters that you're digging in the middle if the ends are at ground level. So you can dig a little in the middle and fill a little at the ends if you want, try to make that a bit better. But in any case, you're trucking dirt. So in the end, the cost goes with something like the length cubed. And it starts to really be dominant when you get above about 40 kilometers. The cost starts to get ridiculous. There are two reasons that come just from the science, let's say scientific motivations. One of them has to do with the instrument, and that's that the noise on this side coming from the suspension system becomes the dominant noise source, becomes the vertical noise. And that's because you're holding this mirror up and there's some noise associated with that. And if that's perpendicular to your beam line, you don't care. But as you get the thing sort of large compared to the size of the Earth, or anyway, not trivial compared to the size of the Earth, you get some angle there. And that angle actually makes a coupling from the vertical motion of your suspensions to the horizontal direction. That coupling is growing linearly with length. So what it means is that on a strain plot where your signal is also growing linearly with length, this thing just stays fixed. All right, so that side just isn't moving anymore as I make it longer. And the last part is that the bandwidth of the detector is shrinking. And that's just because the round trip time in the detector is growing. So this funny feature, which appears here in Cosmic Explorer, is actually what's called the free spectral range. And that's it's the frequency associated with the round trip time of light in the detector. And the detector response starts to get very strange at and above that frequency. In fact, it starts to really die at higher frequencies. So for 40 kilometers, this has hit 3.7 kilohertz. And there's a bunch of interesting astrophysics at around 4 kilohertz. We think that the binary neutron star post-merger signals will live around here somewhere. So we don't really want to pull that thing down into band. Right? So the signal hasn't gone away there, but just a little above that, it starts to really get bad. So there's a sort of astrophysical reason on this end. There's a physical reason on that end, and there's a cost reason as well.
Is there a price tag on this thing yet?
I hesitate mostly because if I quote a number, someday some funding agency is going to hold me to it. Mm-hmm. And the numbers...
Canadian dollars.
Right. That's good. So in some arbitrary monetary units, I would expect it to be roughly 10 to the 9. But that number could easily be off by a factor of 2. But probably not a factor of 10. Right, it's a sort of billion-dollar scale, some dollars.
So could you say a little bit about the technical challenges to building an instrument like Cosmic Explorer? Is it just a matter of spending a lot of money with current technology, or does new technology have to be invented?
Yeah, so in order to get the sensitivity curve I've drawn here, I'm assuming some amount of success in the research which is going on right now in labs for making better detectors, right? So I've tried to be realistic about what I think can be accomplished, but this step here, the better step, is really, you know, how do we make these detectors better? So one feature of that is reducing the thermal noise, and that's this red curve here is as low as it is and kind of uninterestingly low, because I've assumed that we can operate this thing at 123 Kelvin, which is a zero thermal expansion point of silicon. So you put everything on silicon optics. You get a coating which has low mechanical loss and therefore low noise on those silicon optics. You run the whole thing at 1.5 or 2 micron laser wavelength, and then your thermal noises can be essentially irrelevant, right? So that's one of the things I've assumed here. If we use current advanced LIGO technology, this curve is sort of here. It just starts to cut into this sensitivity, right? But it starts to hurt where you're really getting a lot of signal. So a lot of our sources have more signals you go down in frequency. So I've made some assumptions in here about you know, better technology that we'll get as we go along. Obviously, if I don't do that, everyone in the research community will kill me, because I'll say, we're going to use current technology for something 20 years from now. You all don't have a job, right? So I have to do that, right? But also I want to do that, because it means we get, you know, reasonable expectations of kind of this sort of sensitivity. There are other challenges associated just with making it longer. I think it comes down to really nitty-gritty things like the quality of the optical surface of the mirrors. The radii of curvature go from what we have right now, which is roughly 2 kilometers, to something which is roughly 30 kilometer radius of curvature. And then you start worrying a lot about the distortions of that surface and how it scatters light out of the optical mode of your interferometer. So there are surface quality issues. We've studied them some. They don't look tragic, but there'll probably also be unknowns associated with that. Things that you might think will be bad, like alignment control, it turns out that the current interferometers are squirrelier in terms of their alignment than they need to be, just in the sense that we make the beams intentionally large to try to average out the thermal noise. And when you go to a long detector like this, if thermal noise doesn't matter much, you can not do that and end up with a somewhat more stable optical system. So it's not as bad as you might think. If you scale by a factor of 10, it doesn't get 10 times worse in everything. Some of those things right now are hard for other reasons, which we can then ease up on a bit as we get longer detector.
So if we want to further increase the high frequency sensitivity, we might want to consider increase the laser power. So what will be the, ultimate limit for the laser power in this instrument?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. This quantum noise curve, so the fundamental limit that you should always have in mind is that when you turn up the laser power, this part is going to go up. Right? Radiation pressure noise will go up, and this part will go down. Right? And this the place where this corner happens is also pretty arbitrary. It's just a choice of one mirror reflectivity. So we can push this out a bit. We really want to focus on this few kilohertz region for like post-merger signals from neutron stars. But the honesty part is the reason why that is where it is because I just use the advanced LIGO type laser power. And that's there because we don't know that we can actually even get that much power into LIGO. You see that right now we're factor two or so away at high frequency in our detectors because we haven't got all the laser power in. And it's very hard to turn up the power. Now, that shouldn't be an excuse. Like, we should just say, we're going to dedicate a whole research program to high-power laser interferometry, right? That hasn't happened yet. So what I did to make these sensitivity curves was assume that we'd be basically stuck at advanced LIGO design in terms of our power handling. It's not necessarily true. I don't think that we have any better ideas, but yeah, in principle, you could push this down on this side at the expense of radiation pressure by just turning up the laser power. You're going to hit some facility limits, like just the vacuum is not a perfect vacuum. So the gas is left in the arms will limit you eventually. But there is room in here for development, right? You could reasonably expect to get this sort of factor of two or three by just increasing the laser power.
Have you estimated for this detector how well you would measure the Hubble constant?
Yeah. By what means are you thinking?
By measuring.
Yeah. So this calculation has been done. I don't think it requires third generation detectors. So this kind of detector could be detecting binary neutron stars at high redshift, but you're not going to be able to localize them and find their EM counterparts most likely at those high redshifts. So the generation previous to this. We'll probably be doing that as well. I don't remember whether it was 5%. I think the final conclusion was it's going to be very hard to be competitive with other means of determining the same thing at the same point in the future. So if you're thinking 2025, where we're expecting kind of 1% measurements, it doesn't look like we're going to be competitive. So the main argument for using gravitational waves for those things is to have a separate set of systematics and kind of a completely alternate method of confirming what's being done. But my guess is that our error bars will always be somewhat larger. I say this a little bit with a little bit of hesitation because I know that people are currently writing papers about this. And I think the ideas for how we can use gravitational wave data are evolving. Right now, the last I heard was something like 5% error bars. But it's changing. There are other ideas about how to do it. Things like if you're using binary neutron stars and you use the local population to get a good relationship between the post-merger signal, which we should be detecting at this point, and the masses of the neutron stars, then what you'll have is you'll have a mass that you can get just from the signal waveform. And at that point, you can break the mass redshift degeneracy because you have some matter effect which is happening at the source, right? And at that point, you don't need an optical counterpart, right? So there are other ideas being developed of how we can do this and not be limited to things that we can find with telescopes to get our redshift out.
Even the distant stars, won't some of them be accompanied by?
Yeah, redshift of one or two, maybe. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean the short hard gamma ray bursts, I think, are not usually all that far away.
Questions over lunch. You started talking a little bit about how the community is organizing itself to sort of figure out where the best value is in terms of scientific goals per dollar spent. Can mm-hmm. you say a little bit about how that works? Are you part of the astronomy community in that sense, or are you separate?
I wouldn't claim that. Certainly the Gravitational Wave International Committee that's organizing this thing is getting as many astronomers involved as possible with some success. And the idea there is that I'm involved, but only this much. I'm involved in being the instrument expert on that committee, not doing most of the astro stuff. But the idea is that we're gathering the ideas for what we could do with third generation. And it turns out it's a very long laundry list of things, some of which are more valuable than others, things some of which are more probable than others. But trying to gather all these things together and do that while talking to astronomers and figure out what's really most important, and also figure out what's already going to be done by someone else before we can get to it. The collection of like science case targets is very long. So I want to say 100 kind of scale. There are 15-ish. You remember how many working groups are in the 3G WIC?
Yes.
Something like 15, right? Yeah. And each of them will have several different targets. So it's a very long list of stuff from extreme gravity to neutron star equation of state to, you know, I want to test. You think of what are some of the other really, I mean, of course, you have supernovae, you have cosmic strings.
Extreme matters, exotic compact objects, alternative gravity.
There's everything you can imagine is being studied right now to see what we might be able to do with this next generation of detectors. And fundamentally, when you're out there in terms of distance and sensitivity, when SNR is in the sort of hundreds, there are lots and lots of sources that can come in. A lot of what we do is compact binaries. A lot of the other stuff is relatively speculative, but there's a lot you can do with compact binaries.
Unknown sources too, like fast radio bursts.
Yeah, right.
No coincidence been seen yet, but if there is, it would be spectacular.
Yes, very interesting. So, I mean, the unknown is something that I don't usually focus on when I talk about third generation detectors, because I think if I'm going to go and ask for 10 to the 9 monetary units, I can't say, and maybe we'll measure something, right? And I need to have something really solid. But of course, everyone has that as sort of their hope, is that we're not going to be just detecting things that we guessed we would have detected, right? But we don't say that too loudly anymore, because it doesn't feel like a really solid justification for we need more money.
You mentioned that you're digging like a 30-meter trench, this thing. Is it one of those doing that make sense to build the whole thing, or deep underground, or is that much more expensive?
Yeah, so the European design, Einstein telescope design, is intended to be underground. And there are some advantages to going underground in terms of shielding yourself from seismic waves that propagate along the surface, and also from atmospheric Newtonian noise. So it turns out that atmospheric density changes can actually pull your test masses around. It's just the pressure in the air. And so there are advantages to going underground, but generally the cost per unit length is much higher. And that's why they end up at 10 kilometers instead of 40. So if for a very long detector you have to tunnel in the middle, I think you keep that as short as you can. I think most often a bulldozer is cheaper than a tunneling machine. There are some very good reasons to go underground, which I'm hoping we can avoid by being a little more clever, just to avoid the expense.
So you need some triangulation in order to localize the sources in the sky. Does that mean that you need more than one cosmic explorer?
Yeah. So if the Europeans managed to build the Einstein telescope.
But still, you would see more than they, right?
Yeah, right. But there's a lot of, the majority of sources will be common. And if you get to the argument of, we only really need to localize very well the things which are close to us so we can point telescopes at them, then maybe you don't care so much what your localization is for things which are at higher redshift, because you're not quite sure what to do with that localization anyway. Again, there are clever people out there, and people are starting to think maybe we can take the population of binary black holes and map that onto baryon acoustic oscillations and learn something about matter density in the universe. So there are good ideas out there for localization at higher redshifts. I don't know that any of them really need high precision. So as yet to be explored, whether you would need to have a third generation detector. My bet would be that eventually that's going to happen, because the second generation facilities will eventually just die. And maybe someone else in the world will get competitive. China will decide that they're going to build an instrument. It turns out they have a significant amount of research funding. So I wouldn't be so surprised if a third detector came to be without us having to build it ourselves.
What's the timeline for that to happen, more or less? Is it coming before LISA, for example?
So the European effort has some reasonably well-identified funding track. We do not in the U.S. And like, the reason I hesitated on cost, I don't really want to to give a number because we haven't even done a very good costing estimate. We've done a physicist costing estimate, and that can be off by a lot. So I think the Europeans are ahead on this, and they're thinking late 2020s for Einstein telescope. My best guess is that usually from where we are now in the US, the time scale is typically 15 years from you actually have some kind of concept that's well-defined to you have data coming out. And from now to the, you know, I'm starting the design study, I don't know how much time is going to pass. So when I say mid-2030s, I think that's reasonable, but not really solid. My favorite joke on the matter is that it takes sources 5 years to go from LISA band to the ground-based band. So we have 5 years more than they do. So 2040 would be good enough. But that starts to sound a long time from now. I can't really answer until we actually know where we're going to get the money from. And that's not known yet.
Okay. Let me remind you there's snacks down in the bistro if you want to ask Matt some more questions. And let's thank him again.